Before I start, I want to say thank you for being invited to this event. I've been in the industry for almost 10 years, and it's the first time I have a chance to see the Portuguese game dev community, and it's really cool. You guys are awesome. Okay. So about me, my name is Luis, and my goal with this talk is to share some of what I've learned about game design and video games over the last years. It's stuff that I wish I had been told like 10 years ago, and I hope that it'll be useful for you guys. I was born in Lisboa, and I studied in Fine Arts, Faculdade de Belas Artes, Lisboa. 15 years ago, there were no game design degrees or anything remotely close. So I ended up choosing communication design, since I felt was the closest to digital arts and interactivity. I was hoping to learn 3D and have the opportunity to do short movies, animations, illustrations that would give me a feeling of what the industry might be like. Unfortunately, most teachers had little to no professional experience, and the whole course was about creating highly subjective things with fake meanings or any significance. So this forced me to learn 3D on the side during my free time, making sure I would have a portfolio that would allow me to be ready to get a job by the end of my degree. And looking back now, like, I realize how valuable it was for my degree not to teach me anything. Because I learned how important it is to be able to have a goal in whatever project you do. It allows you to question every aspect of it, be aware of the consequences of your decisions, and how they affect the bigger picture. And this is what the talk is going to be about. So after I finished my degree, I learned that Rockstar Games had an opening for an art director in their London studio. So I had no experience, and I decided to apply anyway. They told me they liked my portfolio, and they liked my attitude, but they also told me I had no qualifications. But they hired me as a junior. So this was the first eye-opener, right? Things are not black and white, and there's nothing to lose in trying out for something that might seem totally unreachable. And the funny thing is, like, a year later, we were hiring more artists, and we couldn't get anyone. And then we realized that most people don't apply because they think they will never get the position. We're like, what? So, yeah. So I work on games like Manhunt 2, Midnight Club LA Remix, and then Max Payne 3. So as an artist, this was like the dream job. Okay, I was being paid to create cool characters and environments, surrounded by very talented people, learning new techniques, workflows, and each project was a completely different challenge. But as a gamer, there was something that was bothering me, and I couldn't figure out why. So the first thing is game designers, they only knew how to script. So this means they were dependent on programmers. So in the early stages of a new project, what they would do like a video mock-up, or they would gather some concept images to try to show what the game was going to be about. They would try to convey the emotions you will feel or what the story is about, but games are about mechanics and interactions. And if they wanted to try some actual gameplay concept, they would have to do a paper prototype, or they would need to ask programmers to write something for them. So what this meant was when we started a new project, we were still figuring out what the game would be about. So artists would be creating art at the same time designers were trying to figure out gameplay, which is not good. And this was a long time ago, so there was no Unity or Unreal Editor. The other issue was that every time the game was sent to the higher-ups for review, they would have a far-fetched last-minute request, like, I don't know, like in Manhunt they wanted us to be able to open objects, you know, at the last minute. So this changed the whole game design rules, and just because it made the game cooler. And finally, I realized that most people felt as frustrated as me. Designers wanted to do their job properly, and artists would be saturated with the constant changes. But the way the studio was set up, it just didn't allow room for it. So this image is because GTA, I don't know if you guys know, the jetpack was added at the last minute, and they had to put rooftops on all the buildings, like crunching for a few months because someone else, oh, jetpacks, and it's cool, you know. So at the same time, there were certain games starting to show up more and more on my radar. Do you guys know this game?
Yeah.
Ah, cool. They were different, they were raw, and they were doing very experimental stuff. So this game is called I Wish I Were the Mood by Daniel Benmergui, an Argentinian game designer. It was one of the first art games that I ever tried. And I remember being surprised by the game mechanics. I'm not going to say what the game is about. You guys should check it out. or Cloud from Genova Chen. You know who Genova Chen is? The guy who made Journey. It was a relaxing, non-stressful, meditative experience. So he did this during university. Or Uplink from Introversion, the guys who are doing Prison Architect. A hacking game. Even though the graphics were very simple, they worked well in making you feel like a real hacker. So all these titles were able to speak to me on a more personal level, something else than just mere entertainment. So yeah, I felt it was time for a change. I looked around, and Ubisoft in Quebec, they were starting like a new studio, they were hiring new people, and they wanted to make like a new team with the goal of creating new, unique, original titles. So I was like, yeah, I want to join those guys. So I was hired as a lead artist, and I eventually became art director. So this meant I was doing a lot less art, and there were a lot more meetings, Excel spreadsheets, and mentoring. But I was able to be part of the birth of the game concept. So I had room to question the design. I could try to understand the themes we were going for and make sure the art would go with it. You know, so I could ask stuff like, what are we trying to say to the player on this level? What emotions do we want him to feel? What does this character concept say about him? Which was great. But after a couple of years, I realized that no matter the effort, no matter what great ideas the team would have, we would end up doing facelifts of hit games. So like Street Fighter, Dance Central, or You Don't Know Jack. Yeah. So it's games that in 5 or 10 years, no one will know or even care about. And studios of this size, with this kind of budget, they cannot afford to have a flop. They need to make a profit, and they don't want to take risks. And this is like totally understandable. Like, if you have like 300 people, like, you're gonna need millions to make a game. And if you're a stockholder, you wanna see a return on your investment. And if the game doesn't sell, the studio is gonna close. So that means that these games were just another way to make money. There was little room for innovation, and there was always like a marketing department, usually remote, so they don't know anything about games, with a target audience, and they, you know, use a lot of statistics to decide what they think is the right thing to do. So what I felt was, I'm spending 8 hours per day, every day doing games. I better do something that, you know, has some meaning. So something I always do is compare movies with games. Movies have been around for a long time, and they've gone through all the issues we're going through. Movies had to prove themselves to be more than a gimmick, to become a respected medium that can tell larger stories and be considered an art form. And good film directors, they know how to break down the visual structure of a film and use it to their advantage. So like in this example, Kubrick in The Shining, he used the structure of space to go from one-point perspective to two-dimensionals and accentuate the character's disorientation. He does a lot of other things, like, for example, the, I don't know if you guys know, like, the navigation in the hotel makes no sense. Yeah. So it goes along, or there are shots where there's a painting behind him, then the chain shots, and the painting is no longer there, or a chair. So, you know, he's using the set that he has to accentuate the themes he's working on. Or, for example, I don't know if you guys like The Wire. It's an amazing TV show. So this guy, McNulty, he's like a very... He's very pissed off with himself and his job, and this is a moment where he finally, you know, he's reborn. So all white, super cool. Or on the right, Let the Right One In. It's a movie about vampires, and the director uses colors to accentuate the character's emotions, and there's always red on every single shot because it's about blood. Or Once Upon a Time in the West, where they use rhythm to, you know, extremely long out, slow shots, and then a lot of compacted action too, so that the emotions are stronger. So all these guys are able to use their medium tools to convey a clear message. And that message can be awesome, you know, or it can be cheaper, like the Transformers or Fast and the Furious. But in both these cases, they know exactly what they're doing. The craftsmanship of the shots, the acting, the pacing, like, it's amazing. Like, the Transformers are cheesy as they are, but because they want it to be cheesy, they know exactly what they're doing. They're in full control of the medium, and they achieve a clear goal. And this is what we're still struggling in our industry, right? Games, for the most part, are trying to be movies or reiterations of other games. It also doesn't help that technology is evolving fast. It forces everyone to be in constant change, state of catching up. So what are good examples of what movies are doing? In games, I mean. So Valve, right? They're awesome. So they understand that you should not sacrifice player autonomy over controlled camera angles. You know what I mean, right? Like Tomb Raider, there's a lot, or like Uncharted, you know. So in this example, in episode two, they use this a couple of times where there's birds in front of you and they lift off, you know, and you naturally follow them, and then you look at the tower, you know, and they don't lock you to force to look at the tower, but you'll naturally look there. And if you don't, it's okay, you know. Or another example, Papers, Please, from Lucas Pope. Have you guys played the game?
Yep.
Yeah. So he's able to create a very strong sense of immersion, morality, and emotional reaction into the game mechanics. And Limbo, which is awesome too. Whereby subtracting necessary visual information, the graphics create an artistic unity with the gameplay and extend the narrative ambiguity. So with all this in mind, I decided to leave Ubisoft and I moved to San Francisco to work with Jonathan Blow on The Witness. So I don't know if you guys know about The Witness. I'm going to do a quick overview. It's a first-person puzzle adventure game in an uninhabited island. The island is divided into areas, which one has its own theme, like kind of Disneyland. Each area has a set of puzzles that unlocks a laser that allows you to access the final area and complete the game. You're free to roam anywhere you want on the island. There's some audio recordings, and there's no text, and nothing is explained to the player. It's up to you to find meaning through exploration. So working on this project, surrounded by really cool developers, it was the first time I realized that I was not alone in the way I saw games. You know, all the stuff I was complaining about, I was like, yeah. There's a lot of people doing incredible things with game design. And you can find them if you know where to look. So Jonathan, for example, he's surrounded by really cool guys, like doing amazing stuff. Yeah, should have shown, this is the laser connecting on the mountain. So Spy Party by Chris Hecker. It's an asymmetrical game about subtle behaviors. You guys know about it?
Yeah.
So, okay, so I'll skip it. Daniel Ben-Marghi is doing another one called Storyteller. He's been doing this for ages, where you build visual stories by changing the placement of characters and objects. Very interesting. And Mark Ten Bosch with Mia Gagure. It's a platform game in the fourth dimension. So all these are original titles. They expand on existing game mechanics or create new ones. And they all take them in different directions. And each one of these concepts would not work in any other medium but games. So back to The Witness. How was this different from any other studio? So the first thing is the way Jonathan runs the studio. There's no titles, there's no leads. Everyone is responsible for their work and their own schedule, which means there's no official work hours and there's no maximum vacations or sick days. So at the start, this was strange for me. You know, I felt really guilty when I wanted to take a day off. But then you realize you're being empowered and trusted. You don't feel like abusing the system, but rather build upon it. It naturally makes you more passionate and makes you give your best. So you have an idea, like in 4 years, we only crunched for 1 week to make a trailer. And this was like 2 extra hours per day. And then we got a week off. And at Rockstar, I crunched for 11 months, including weekends to finish a game. The other way is the way he does games. So the same way you're supposed to have a script before you start shooting a movie, you should know what your game is about before you hire other people. So similarly as Braid, the art team was brought in when the core of the game was complete and like 90% of the puzzles were done. So this is how it looked when I joined in. But you could sit down and you could play the game from start to a very rough ending. It looked like shit. But you could experience the game, you know, you could understand the concepts and the ideas behind it. And this means we had a very solid foundation to start from. And Jonathan knew, like, what the message of the game was. So when we had to find the art direction, you know, we had, every decision we had could have a reasoning behind it. I made a talk about this at GDC, so I'm not gonna go over this in detail. But the idea is that we should be aware that visuals are the primary channel of how information gets into your mind from the game. So you have to be very careful that the things that grab your attention are the things that are most meaningful. And having this rough template to work from, we're able to effectively make sure that the art would support and extend the gameplay principles. You know, from the colors, the shapes, and the placement of objects, they all worked alongside the mechanics. They were extensions of the game design and themes of the game. Which leads me to my current project, 12 Minutes. So it's a top-down adventure game in real time, where just like Groundhog Day, you're stuck in a time loop. The game happens inside this apartment, and the loop lasts 12 minutes. There's no objective. The game never tells you what to do. It's up to you, the player, to do what you believe is the right thing to fix the loop. So I'm going to try to explain how everything that I learned was applied in this title, I hope. You know. So I've had this idea since I was at Rockstar, so like 8 or 9 years ago. At the time, I had no programming knowledge, so I would keep trying to get programmers to join in on the project. You know, I'd show them concepts and design documents of how I imagined the game would be. But I realized, you know, trying to do your own game without knowing how to program is like trying to be an artist without knowing how to draw. You know, you're going to have someone that actually knows how to draw to create your vision, and that's going to dilute and distort the whole creative process, not to mention how much more time it requires. So in this project, what was my goal? What was I trying to say? I wanted to create a game that explores the concept of time loops. And if you think about it, it's a natural occurrence in video games. Every time you die, you restart, and you play the same sequence over and over. And it's the knowledge you have of what happened that allows you to move forward. So I asked myself, what if the character is aware of this? What if the game design isn't trying to hide the repetition, but embraces it? So while I was at Rockstar, right, my ideas were huge because of GTA and stuff. So I thought about a small city with 100 people, a 24-hour cycle. You know, every action you do would have a huge repercussion. Like, I had stuff like, you cause a traffic accident, you force your boss to be late to work, you delay a meeting he's supposed to have, which makes someone else to be fired, so that guy has a free day, you know, and yeah, I thought this was awesome, but yeah. So when I sat down 3 years later, this was 3 years ago, I sat down and I started to finally start to, actually before that, so when I joined Jonathan, he's the one who made me aware, like, you gotta learn how to program. So I learned how to program for a year, and then I sat down and started to work on the game design. And then I realized, 24 hours make no sense, right? You're artificially speeding up time, and outlies a flaw on a long time span. Like, how can you have a realistic character routines if an hour lasts like 2 minutes? Everything will be artificially compressed, and even if a day is only 50 minutes, like, what happens if you fail a task at minute 49? You're gonna have to redo everything again. So just like what I did for the art style on The Witness, I stripped out all the noise and reduced the idea to its bare bones. This allowed me to organically understand what are the mechanics and themes of a time loop and be able to explore them. So I realized the game is about knowledge, right? It's about what you learn. At the end of each loop, you learn a bit more about the characters and the world. And that accumulated knowledge changes your behavior. And this shift in perspective makes you deal with the same problems differently. And not being told what to do. So the game never tells you at all what to do. It's up to you to assume what you believe are the right things to do. And since you're not told what to do, when you have the possibility to express yourself, it makes a huge difference. I always thought the game would be about the main character, you know, following a rigid storyline, but it's much more about the player and how he decides to interpret and deal with what he has learned. And the same thing is about, you know, the game design itself. I'm going to use the user interface of my game as an example. So I love, you know, point-and-click games like Monkey Island, Day of the Tentacle. I play them all. And I loved them when I was a kid. These games, like, you have a verb, and you combine verbs with objects, and it seems you can do anything, right? But you can't. Like, the core of a good puzzle game design means that you're able to form a plan, you execute that plan, and then you see why the plan didn't work, so you can form a new plan. As an example, like Super Mario, like, super good game. So first you learn the rules of the world very fast. You know how high you can jump, how fast you can move, and you know how to kill characters. And you understand the combinations you can do with them. So if you see a gap, you can plan ahead what you're gonna do. I'm gonna jump. And if you fail the jump and you die, like, even before you restart, you're like, okay, I should have, you know, ran faster, maybe I should have double jumped. And you plan this in your head, you do it, and it works. And this loop in your head is what makes the magic, you know, that's what's extremely satisfying. And going back to adventure games, I don't know if you guys know this puzzle in The Longest Journey. Like, the most, in adventure games, the reason why the plan doesn't work is because the engine doesn't allow you to do the thing you would need to do. So you can never make a plan. So all you do is brute force your way, trying all the options you can find until you eventually figure out what the hell the designer wanted you to do. So how did I fix this in 12 minutes? So I started with verbs too. I was like, yeah, I love verbs. So on the prototype, yeah, originally there was verbs. Everyone was super confused. And you could, so the way the game works is you drag like the cup to the sink, right? But before you could drag everything to everywhere. So people would drag like the wife to the couch, or the wife to the door, or the wife to the player, or the window to the wife. And first I realized I couldn't do these combinations. And then it was like, it was very like, what happens if you drag the wife to the window? She jumps out the window? You tell her to jump out the window? You want to talk to her about the window? Like, so I changed it. You can only drag objects from your inventory towards things you can pick up are the only things you can drag to the world. So this reduced the amount of combinations, which makes the player immediately is a lot more relaxed because he can assess what he can do. And all the objects in the game are objects that have, you can understand their purpose, you know. So a glass, you know, you can fill it with water. Like the keys, I'm sure you guys are like, oh, I can lock a door with it. The knife, maybe stab someone. And before I had stuff like an apple and the wallet, and you're like, what do you do with an apple? Also, because of the dragging, you understand the rules of the world, you know. So you'll never try, like, a lot of players at the start will try to block the door. There's a cop coming out to beat up the wife and you. So you try to lock the door. You wanted to drag the couch to block the door, but you know it's not allowed in the world. You know, like in a shooter, you don't pick up a rock from the floor. You just know you can't do it. So yeah, so what did I learn from all this? And the things I think are important. The first one is understand your idea. So you have a cool idea for a game. You gotta try to understand why you think it's cool and remove all the noise around it so you can clearly see what it's about. And then start playing with it until you find out what it's saying to you. Like, you need to find the fun in your game, and you need to find the fun in your gameplay loop. But just like a film classic, you gotta try to do more, you gotta put more layers, make it more rich, find how the theme of the game speaks to you. And this is what will make your game stand out from all the others. The second thing is understanding your medium. So it's very important to know the language of video games. You know, this is not a movie, it's interactive, it's dynamic, there's a relationship between you and the player, it's a dialogue. So the way you define this interaction will affect the play in very deep ways. So you guys played co-op? So, like, do I make the controls allow the player to feel super agile like in Assassin's Creed, or the opposite, you know, like clumsy and slow? And how will the player feel about this decision that I made as a game designer? Does it work towards what I'm trying to say? And this is the most important one for me, to have a reason. Do you know this game? It's Duke Nukem Forever. So this looks like it's a mess, right? You gotta have a reason for everything you do. So very often we don't stop and ask why. You know, especially artists, you know, you just do something that's cool, then you have a guy with a huge arm and swords and there's no point to it. So you should always look back and see if you are too far, otherwise you become, yeah, a mess like this. Yeah. And this is like a game I love, which does it very well. So analyze your decisions against what your original goal was. It's okay if they take some place new. Yeah, like, what I mean is, like, you have a concept you want to work from, but you don't have to be rigidly locked on that concept. It can grow and it can become something else, but you have to be aware and in control. So just like in painting, where every single brush stroke will add or remove from the final picture, the way you communicate to the player, the shapes and movement of your game, they will all need to justify themselves to that bigger goal. And finally, be part of the community. So games are huge, and we're all connected. I was having just a talk before about this, like, how can we connect internationally? I don't think that exists anymore. Like, we're all connected now. There's tons of game developers out there. Like, the way I got hired for The Witness was by talking with Chris Hacker, like, by email about his game, and we just started to chat. There's a lot of game designers out there, and it's very likely they have gone through the same problems and ideas as you. And it's very easy to contact them. There's Twitter, there's Twitch, there's YouTube, and everyone has a development blog nowadays. And if your idea is worthwhile, it's gonna resonate with someone else, and it might grow into something beautiful. I wrote here an example. Lucas Pope, he's doing a new game called Obra Dinn, and he's sharing it on TeekSource. I mean, everything. He goes from his shaders to game design, the characters, the workflow, and you can chat with him there, you know, like, it's awesome. It's very educative. Also, there's tons of talks and tutorials, GDC Vault, Gamma Sutra, SIGGRAPH, YouTube, all free and available for everyone. That's it. The end.